Good morning. Today is Friday, December 10th, and you're listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Taylor Chalstrom. This episode features information from California Farm Water Coalition's Mike Wade on the good, the bad, and the ugly for the state's water and what it could mean if we have another dry year. After that, we'll review today's national and regional news, and we'll finish off the show with information about an integrated approach to managing pocket gophers in fields and orchards. We'll dive in right after this.
Being a member of the California walnut industry means working together to advance the industry through advocacy, research programs, and promoting walnuts with smart, cost-effective marketing, activities that are often too big for one operation to tackle on its own. There are unique ways the California Walnut Board and Commission deliver value. For example, health research gives consumers more reasons to believe in walnuts, while new and improved walnut varieties and production methods increase profitability, and it ensures the issues facing our industry are in the front of government decision makers. Learn more at walnuts.org.
California is constantly dealing with water issues, and while things might seem dire, California Farm Water Coalition's Mike Wade says it's not all doom and gloom. There is some good amongst the bad and the ugly.
We're very optimistic about the infrastructure spending bill that was passed. We're appreciative that Congress and the Senate got those pushed through and that the president signed them. It means over $5 billion in investments in California water infrastructure, and that is a huge deal. We're really pleased to see that, and there are a number of projects that we can use in terms of additional water supply, improving some of our infrastructure, repairing canals, helping to develop groundwater storage, a whole host of things, kind of the all of the above approach to water supply for this year.
While California Farm Water Coalition is a nonprofit and doesn't necessarily lobby on these types of issues, they do educate in other ways.
We do provide educational materials. We help policymakers and legislators understand what's really needed, where we need infrastructure investments, how agriculture is using water, and we help, you know, a tremendous amount to help the public understand the connection between farm water and their food supply.
Looking at different solutions to California's water management problems, Wade notes that voluntary agreements, which are collaborative agreements between water users and water regulators, can help.
In a classic sense, it would be investing at the local level on infrastructure improvements, on the kinds of things that improve habitat for endangered species, to improve salmon spawning habitat, for instance, or building side channels on rivers. And we've seen a tremendous benefit over the years where these kinds of activities with local, state, and federal support have done tremendously to improve the situation, the ecosystem for threatened and endangered fish. So when we've got investments that need to be made, we have to look at kind of a broad spectrum of solutions. And one of them certainly is water supply, having the right river flows at the right time, but then also having the resources in the river for fish for reproduction. And that's essentially what the voluntary agreements are all about.
At the moment, some of the proposed voluntary agreements for the state's water supplies seem to be stagnating, but some are still alive.
They're still looking at the same types of activities in the Sacramento Valley. And I know the State Water Resources Control Board is discussing those issues as we speak. And you know, we're waiting to see the outcome, but we still think that there are solutions that can be had through a combination of efforts that include stream flow, include Bay Delta water quality, and include locally funded and managed voluntary agreement type projects.
One issue water users have continued to grapple with in California is rising costs and decreased water supply. Wade outlines what the inevitable consequences of this trend could be in the future, and that it's critical that the state steers clear of this outcome.
One of the first things that will happen, and that we've already seen happen in previous droughts and in the current drought, and anytime we have water supply shortages and the cost of water increases, is that farmers take land out of production. They reduce the number of crops that they grow, the number of acres that are planted, and they're usually annual crops where they can fallow them to save precious water and expensive water for their bigger investments. And usually those are permanent crops, whether they're orchards or vineyards. Farmers are protecting their long-term investment when we're in a drought. So that's one of the first things we see. As a result of that, we see a reduction in the kinds of and the variety of fresh fruits and vegetables that make it to market. And the problem with that is we generally see a consolidation of the kinds of crops that are grown and a reduction in the diversity of crops that are grown in California, which is opposite of what consumers want. And then lastly, once it makes its way through the food chain, if you will, is consumers experience higher prices.
And Wade says we've already seen this trend with processing tomatoes.
California is the number one producer of processing tomatoes in the U.S. We actually grow 30 times the processing tomatoes that the number two state, Indiana, grows in a year. Yet with the drought and with water supply cuts and the reduction in plantings over the last year or two, just this year from January to April, we saw processing tomato wholesale prices go up 22%. And that's going to have a ripple effect as it works its way through the market, through all the products that consumers want, whether it's spaghetti sauce or salsa or soups and stews, all of the things that processed tomatoes go into, those are affected ultimately by higher prices.
Clearly, solving California's water regulatory issues would be no small task. The state really needs to backtrack some of its policies, and Wade said that starts with educating policymakers.
I think there's just a very little understanding about the importance of California agriculture, and not just because we've got tens of thousands of family farmers, or we support the rural economy and a lot of people and jobs, both within the San Joaquin and Sacramento valleys, but outside of the valleys as well in associated businesses. But the critical thing to understand is California's importance for the rest of the nation as a food supplier is unparalleled. We actually grow more fresh fruits, nuts, and vegetables than the 49 other states combined. And when California production is reduced, we see a ripple effect across the country. We see foreign competitors coming in to fill the void. And they're usually countries that don't have the same kinds of food safety protections and pesticide rules that California farmers follow.
California grows over 400 commodities, and processing tomatoes aren't the only commodity being hit hard.
I think anything that's in line for annual fallowing could be affected. Forage crops for dairies is one that gets hit. We also see the same kind of effect in melons, in peppers, other fresh truck crops, the row crops that grow predominantly throughout the San Joaquin Valley.
Another issue Californians might face is an end to water rights if federal agencies attempt to revert to, quote, old outdated operating rules for both the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project. Wade said this is often touted as an easy fix when the opposite is actually true. He explained the core of this issue and what could happen if something like it is enacted.
The old operating rules take us back to the 2008 and 2009 biological opinions, which in effect are a set of operating rules for moving water around the state, primarily through the Delta. Those rules were in effect for 10 years, and they harmed water supply. They would continue to diminish the amount of water that we have available for farms. But the sad part is, they're not doing anything to help fish. We've seen salmon and Delta smelt populations continue to decline over the 10 years that those earlier biological opinions were in effect. And that's the world that we're going back to if some of the proposals are put into place. With respect to water rights, there are some potential changes on how we manage our water supply in California, and that could have a ripple effect into water rights. And it's a slippery slope. California water rights go back more than 100 years to the gold rush and are actually rooted in English common law. And so they're a vested property right, and they're something that holds value for individual farmers that are growing food and fiber products for California consumers, which is really what it's all about.
With a multitude of water issues looming over the state, Wade explained how Californians and the ag industry in general can work towards a prevention strategy.
What our policymakers need to understand is that farmers are here to grow the food that the population needs. And people want California-produced food. All of the studies that we've done, the surveys and research into consumer preferences is that they like California farms. They like the fact that we're growing food essentially in their own backyard. It's being grown under the safest conditions anywhere on the planet. And consumers, by and large, really are interested in a safe and affordable food supply. It comes down to that. And if our policymakers are really interested in supporting agriculture, they'll make sure that there's abundant water supplies to grow the food that ultimately go to the people of California.
That was Mike Wade with the California Farm Water Coalition. We will be right back after this break with today's national and regional news.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
We're back with today's national news. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey has the National Weather Service's outlook heading into the second half of December.
Even though it feels a little bit more normal across much of the country right now, this crazy warmth is going to return by mid-December, especially across the central and eastern United States. We are looking at a very great likelihood of normal or even much above normal temperatures extending all the way from the central and southern plains through the Midwest and into the eastern United States. We will see, however, some cooler conditions arriving in the far west, primarily the Pacific Coast states. Now, in terms of precipitation from December 14th through the 20th, a lot of the country looks pretty quiet. That includes much of the Great Plains, as well as the South and the East. We will, however, see some wetter weather developing, much needed wet weather in the West. And that is good news for the lack of snow cover and for the drought affected areas of the Western U.S. Eventually, as we move through this period, the 14th through the 20th, we could also see a wetter pattern starting to set up from the Mid-South into the Mid-Mississippi Valley and parts of the Great Lakes region.
Like Rippey expected, many areas of the country have hit record high temperatures for the month of December. USDA's Stephanie Ho reports.
There was record-setting warmth in many parts of the country.
We saw some of the warmest, if not the warmest, December weather that we have ever seen in dozens of locations, all the way from the Pacific Coast states on through the Great Plains and into parts of the southeastern United States.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says it reached 85 degrees in Salinas, California on December 1st, with temperatures soaring into the 70s in other places.
Hettinger, North Dakota hitting 71 degrees on December 1st, and that set an all-time state record for the month of December, a record that had stood since 1894 when it was 70 degrees in the community of Napoleon, North Dakota.
The warmth continued through states like Montana, Kansas, and Nebraska.
And then by the time we got to December 3rd, that warmth spread into the southeast. Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina, tying a December record with 79 degrees.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
In other news, results are in for the 2022 World Ag Expo's Top 10 New Products Competition. Products in this year's field ranged from simple solutions to high-tech devices. The contest judges were made up of farmers, ranchers, and industry professionals. The first product was an all-electric Class 8 refrigerated truck from Hummingbird EV. These trucks handle the movement of ag goods from farm to warehouse, warehouse to packing centers to cold storage to retail warehouses, and from retail warehouses to consumers, all with zero emissions. From Neo Technologies comes a new smart autonomous robot, a sustainable, serviceable, and smart farming solution that combines robotics and artificial intelligence and is dedicated to large-scale vegetable crops that will be previewed at the World Ag Expo. From Rainbird comes Clip Plugs, which help save water by providing a simple way for growers to close emitter outlets when using heavy wall drip line. Solitrack earned a spot on the list with their E70N electric tractor, a 70 horsepower equivalent, 100% battery powered electric tractor that offers all of the power of a similar sized diesel tractor but eliminates the diesel exhaust and associated emissions and noise while providing instant torque. Livestock-related technology won as well. TJ Hoof Hub's TJ Hoof Care, a mobile data management solution that allows hoof trimmers to digitally document all of their work, including photos for healing, progress management, generate various hoof health reports, manage and view calendars, and create custom treatment items and pricing, among other items. Next up on the list is Burrow, a people-scaled collaborative robot designed to help people work more productively while building a base platform for more automation where it is needed most. Burrows use computer vision, high-precision GPS, and AI to navigate autonomously alongside people while scouting crops and carrying produce, autonomous tools, and/or other payloads. Another automated technology, the Mini Gus from Gus Automation, is a new, more compact version of Gus and allows vineyards, hops, blueberry, and high-density orchard growers to take greater advantage of autonomous sprayers. The IT Rover from InsightTrack is a ground robot that travels down orchard rows, taking action on reducing pest populations and collecting data, providing further insight into the crop's performance, one as well. More on this technology can be found in next month's edition of West Coast Nut magazine. For dairy tech, the Teat Wand Parallel from On-Farm Solutions took the prize. It's the first and only parallel parlor, in-parlor automated teat spraying system in the world. Last but not least was Thule Technologies' Thule Vision, an iPhone app that uses artificial intelligence to allow users to take and track midday leaf water potential readings in grapevines. The winners will be showcased February 8th to 10th during World Ag Expo in Tulare, California.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Many growers in the state of California have the unfortunate knowledge of pocket gophers, a rampant burrowing rodent pest in fields and orchards. Pocket gophers range from 6 to 8 inches in length and are rarely seen above ground. Since this is the case, growers need to look for other signs, such as plugged, fan-shaped mounds on the soil. Average loss in revenue from this pest varies depending on the crop, but UC Resources state losses can be close to 9% in infested alfalfa fields, and losses in tree nuts typically fall in the 6% range. UCCE wildlife specialist Roger Baldwin recently reviewed viable control strategies for pocket gophers during the virtual 2021 Sac Valley Orchard IPM meeting.
I do certainly recommend that individuals utilize an integrated approach. By utilizing multiple strategies, you're usually going to have better results than if you relied on any single one approach. There's a number of different potential tools that could be used to manage gophers, and there isn't necessarily a right or wrong combination of those tools that you can use. One example might be to initially go out with a bait application to knock down populations and then follow that up with a trapping program to target some of those remaining individuals. Like I said, you know, the tools that you use will vary from site to site and situation to situation, but it is important to keep in mind that mixing and matching those tools is usually going to work a lot better than relying on just one tool continuously over time.
Growers have a few management options at their fingertips, with viable ones being habitat modification, baiting, burrow fumigation, and trapping. Exclusion strategies, frightening, and shooting aren't as viable, according to Baldwin, and usefulness of repellents for pocket gover control is still up in the air as well.
There is a repellent called Protect-T that was just registered for use in California earlier this year. It's the active ingredient is methyl mercaptan, and it's forced through subsurface drip irrigation tubing with irrigation water. And so if you're somebody who uses SDI, that's something that you could potentially look at to try to help reduce gopher pressure in a particular area. I've done some very early preliminary work that showed at least some level of repellency for it, but really there's a lot more work that needs to be done to determine if this is actually a really good effective repellent or not. So stay tuned on that.
Biocontrol, or use of natural predators against a pest, is another good option for getting at least some control of pocket gophers. Baldwin said that the biocontrol, quote, poster child for pocket gophers is the barn owl, and the reason why is...
We can put up barn owl boxes throughout an orchard, hopefully thereby encouraging barn owls to utilize these boxes. Barn owls tend to be relatively non-territorial, so we can artificially inflate barn owl densities in a given area. And barn owls do consume a large number of rodents, including gophers. In fact, a breeding pair might consume 1,000 to 3,000 gophers in a particular year. So certainly they are very efficient predators of rodents, including gophers. There's more and more research looking into the efficacy of barn owls for managing rodents. A lot of this information is inconclusive at this point. But like I said, there's a lot of studies on it right now. And some of the early returns on those studies do seem to suggest at least some potential reduction in gopher numbers when you have a relatively high barn owl density in a particular area.
Some research on the efficacy of barn owls for controlling pocket gophers may still be a bit inconclusive, but Baldwin said it still doesn't hurt to have them.
It certainly, I think, could be a part of an IPM program to manage gophers, and it's something that I hope we'll have a better answer for moving forward in the future. But I do keep in mind that, you know, putting up barn owl boxes in and of itself probably isn't going to be enough to substantially reduce gopher populations in a given area. So it really depends on what your threshold for gophers are in a particular site and whether or not you're going to need additional tools. But probably you are going to need additional tools at a minimum, even if utilizing barn owls and barn owl boxes.
Habitat modification involves altering the desirability of an area for a specific pest. Baldwin outlined some of the ways that growers can go about doing that.
One of the tools that sometimes is used is burrow destruction. You'll keep in mind when you have an extensive gopher network out there in an orchard system, even if you get rid of 100% of the gophers out there, there's always going to be adjacent populations of gophers that are going to reinvade an area. And when you have extant burrow systems and tunnels out there, that's going to allow for rapid, quick reinvasion of an orchard. So if you were able to destroy those old burrow systems, then that certainly can substantially slow down that reinvasion. We can do that through deep ripping. Of course, this isn't practical in an orchard, but if you're going to take an orchard out of production and then replant it, then you could go through that deep ripping process to destroy old burrow systems. And so that can be a good tool. There's actual research on this for ground squirrels, not much for gophers. So I can't tell you exactly the depth you need to go, but it's probably at least a foot and maybe a foot and a half deep. Also, you know, gophers, like all animals, have preferred food resources. And in particular, they like nitrogen fixing plants, plants with large fleshy taproots, et cetera. So keep that in mind if you're planting cover crops, you know, planting a lot of clovers, legumes, things like that are going to increase the carrying capacity for gophers in a particular area and potentially increase your problem with gophers. So if you're somebody who has consistent problems with gophers, maybe there are alternative plants that you may want to include in a cover crop.
Trapping for pocket gophers also seems to be effective. Baldwin said that research points to the Gophinator trap being one of the most effective trapping tools available.
If you're somebody who likes to utilize trapping as a tool to manage gophers, I certainly would encourage checking out this Gophinator trap, as it seems to be a really good trap. But there's a variety of different Transis traps out there, and they all work to some extent. Most of them are pretty effective, but some I do think are probably a little bit more effective than others.
UC research has also looked at whether or not pocket gophers are put off by human scent that might linger on the trap after placing it in a burrow. Current research seems to conclude that this isn't an issue.
This was very definitive. We really did not have any impact or see any impact of human scent on our ability to catch gophers. So no concerns there.
As for the overall effectiveness of trapping as a control method,
turns out it's highly effective. We've seen 92 to 94% removal rates of gophers in a couple of different cropping systems when utilizing trapping. So trapping is a very good tool for managing pocket gophers.
Use of poison baits to control rodents is another option. There are restricted use and non-restricted use baits. Ones available for pocket gopher control include first generation anticoagulants, zinc phosphide, and strychnine. Of these, Baldwin noted strychnine to be the most efficacious.
I've seen that in both lab and field trials, whereas lots of other researchers over the years have also consistently found that strychnine works better than the others. So for me personally, I would kind of focus more on strychnine if you can find it.
Last but not least on Baldwin's list of control options was fumigation, which pumps poison gas into the burrows of pocket gophers to control them. However, this option requires some very particular conditions.
They work best when soil moisture is high, and this is a really key aspect of fumigants. You do need high soil moisture for them to work well. So, you know, here that's usually starting now through mid-spring or so. Whenever you've got that high soil moisture, basically, is when they're going to work well.
Baldwin also said fumigants are to never be used around structures.
You don't know where these tunnel systems always go. Sometimes they lead up and underneath structures. And if so, then those gases can leak up into those structures and cause people, pets, or livestock to potentially get sick or even and die from that exposure. So we do have to be careful. Most of the labels require you to be 100 feet away from a structure that is or potentially may be occupied, but read the label. Sometimes some of them have shorter restrictions on that.
That was Roger Baldwin with the University of California Cooperative Extension. This is Taylor with My Ag Life signing off. Thanks for listening.
Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. Desal, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. Desal will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's Desal flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With Desal, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.